The following Bible study is presented by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
We'll go ahead and get started. And this is a fairly lengthy Bible study. It's going to be one of the longer ones, I think, that I have done anyway. There's a lot to cover. And even though I am fairly note-bound in most of my sermons or studies, the reason being I really like to try to be as thorough as I can, and I frankly have a difficult time remembering everything that I think would be helpful to be included in these studies. So perhaps even more so tonight because there is so much material to cover. So let's just go ahead and go dive right into it here and go over to Leviticus chapter 2. Leviticus and the second chapter. And we are going to begin there. In the last study that we went through about a month ago, we read Leviticus chapter 1. We had discussed the burnt offerings there, and we saw how that offering represented Christ in a variety of ways, but also how that representation applies to each of us who say that we are Christian, meaning that we are called by his name, Christ-like, God's people, in other words. So tonight we move into Leviticus chapter 2 to discuss the details of the grain offerings. Now, the burnt offerings and the grain offerings, they were more than one offering, but they fall into a category of offerings. And as we read through chapter 2 this evening, we'll see that different translations, and as you, I don't know what translation each of you were using, but different translations call this a meat offering. Some call it a meal offering, and the translation I am reading from, the New King James, calls it a grain offering. And the translations come from the fact that the Hebrew term mincha means a voluntary offering that is bloodless. And so the fact that it is grain is understood as we read through this chapter describing how it was prepared and how it was to be offered. And so let's read the first three verses here in Leviticus 2, verse 1. When anyone offers a grain offering to the Eternal, his offering shall be of fine flour. He shall pour oil on it and put frankincense on it. He shall bring it to Aaron's sons, the priests, one of whom shall take from it his handful of fine flour and oil with all the frankincense, and the priest shall burn it as a memorial on the altar, an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to the Eternal. And the rest of the grain offering shall be Aaron's and his sons. It is most holy of the offerings to the Eternal made by fire. And so like the burnt offering, there was a portion of grain to be burned on the altar as a memorial, it says, and it's also called a sweet aroma to the Eternal. Now, like the burnt offering, this is a free will offering, and it was not given as a result of sin, but it was given instead in reverence to God and in love for God. And as we will see as we move forward, is also included a love for our neighbor. In other words, our fellow man or mankind. So in this way, the offering represents Christ, who gave himself, offered himself to God on our behalf. And it was because of his love for the Father. And so a portion of the offering was put on the brazen altar and burned there. But another portion was also given to the priest and his sons. And this shows us that it related to Christ having a love also for mankind. And so let's, if you have a ribbon, go ahead and put it here in Leviticus chapter 2. And we're going to go all the way back to Genesis and chapter 1. Genesis 1. Like the burnt offering, the symbolism of the grain includes how Christ should be reflected in each of our lives. And so we give of our time, our labor, the fruit of our efforts, we give this as an offering to God, and it's out of reverence for him. It's out of love for him. And so everything that we do falls within the boundaries of keeping God's law. But we should also be making a similar offering, that is, to those people around us. Also, again, within the boundaries of God's law. And this is what Christ did as he came to be a servant to other people. And he helped everyone where he could, every place that he was able. And as the familiar phrase in 1 John 2 and verse 6 says, that he who says he abides in him ought himself also to walk even as he walked. And so let's examine this then further by considering the ingredients of the offering. And as we had read in those first verses there, it consisted of fine flour and oil and frankincense. Now there was one more ingredient that was included in most of these offerings, and that is salt. And so we'll mention that a bit later as we read more of Leviticus 2. But flour, when we consider the term flour, I think most of us understand what that is referring to. It's indicative of a grain that is not only beaten and dried out and perhaps burned in some way, but it's ground into powder. The oil that was used was commonly olive oil, and it is the most healthful of all oils, actually. And then it also, the offering consisted of frankincense, and this is an aromatic resin that comes from a variety of trees that is of the genus Boswellia. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that is the type of trees that produce this resin that is called frankincense. Now, something that we notice when we read of the offerings to be given throughout the year is that burnt offerings always included grain offerings along with it. And if you read through the places where God requires the priests to make certain offerings, you'll see that the burnt offering and its grain offering is to be this. The burnt offering is this, and then its grain offering at the same time is to be this. And the reason is because there is a similarity, of course, in the two offerings, the two types of offerings, but also there is a difference in the fact that this offering, the grain offering that is, did not include a need to take a life found in the blood, an animal that has blood giving it life. So God said that blood shall not be eaten, as life is in the blood. And so animals, they had to be drained when they were slaughtered. The blood had to be drained out of the animals before they were eaten, and also before they were offered to God. But the grain offering, obviously, it had no blood in it. It was a meal that came from the earth. It was fruit from the earth. And so this food was created by God, but it was given to mankind through the flora that he had made during the 7 days of recreation there. And so in Genesis 1, verse 29, it says here, God said, "See, I have given you," speaking to Adam and Eve, "I have given you every herb that yields seed, and every tree whose fruit yields seed. And to you it shall be for food." And so God gave us all kinds of edible fruit and vegetables and legumes and grains of the earth. And the offering, therefore, it portrays that God gave something to us, and it portrays the fact that we should desire to give something back to God out of reverence for him, out of appreciation for him. And though everything in the entire universe is his property, we're all just, you know, we're using it. He allows us to use it. In order for this offering, in order to give this offering to God, it took an effort by the one who would offer it. So they, you know, perhaps they had to sow it in the first place, but then they would also have to take care of it. Then they would have to reap it, and then they would have to grind it, and then, or press oil, or, you know, process frankincense or gather salt. It took effort in order to give this offering to God, just as it took effort to give a burnt offering. And so it was presented to God, but we see that a portion was also given to the priests, representing the efforts that you and I should be making to give ourselves in service to God, but also to give ourselves in service to other people. Whether it's the fruit of the ground that we might produce, or perhaps our efforts in life, the work that we do, or assisting people in some way, it's all a gift. Our life is a very gift that God has given us. And so isn't it proper then that we should want to give something to God and to other people? And the reason for both is out of love. And we're going to see that as we go forward in the study this evening. Let's go over to Mark 12. Mark 12. The Bible, in fact, it tells us that we cannot have a true love for God if we do not love our neighbor. And I'm not just speaking about the physical neighbor that you might live next door to, but our neighbor means other people, other individuals, whether in the Church of God or not. There is a measure of love that we should have for all people. Now, in this regard, Jesus answered a scribe who had asked him a question about this concept. In Mark 12 and verse 28, one of the scribes came to Christ, having heard them reasoning together, perceiving that he had answered them well. And he asked him, "What is the first commandment?" In other words, the first commandment of all. What's the greatest commandment of them all? And Jesus answered him in verse 29, "The first of all the commandments is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Eternal, your God, our God, the Lord, is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment.'" In other words, he is summarizing the first four, possibly five, of the commandments. A love for God. Here's how you show love for God in the first commandments. And the second, he continues in verse 31, and the second is like it. It is this: "You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And there is no other commandment greater than these." In other words, what he was doing is summarizing the last half of the commandments, the ones that explain how we show love for other people. And so the scribe said to him in verse 32, "Well said, teacher, you have spoken the truth, for there is one God, and there is no other but He. And to love Him with all your heart, with all your understanding, with all of your life, and with all of your strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself is more than all the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices." Now, isn't it interesting? This gentleman had a measure of understanding, didn't he? That he understood that the offerings and the sacrifices, that they are directly related to love for God and love for others. And when Jesus saw that he answered wisely, and this is verse 34, he said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." And so we see that this scribe, he understood a great deal of this connection between the offerings, between the sacrifices, and how they are directly related to love for God and to love for others. Now, Christ had said in another place that on these two principles, love for God and love for our neighbor, hangs the entire law and all of the teachings of the prophets. And that is why they are portrayed, I think, in the first two offerings that are offered together, the burnt offering and its grain offering. And if you read through it, I'm not going to read through it right now for time's sake, but if you go and look at Numbers 28 and Numbers 29, it goes through and it says, "The burnt offering shall be this, 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 and at such and such a time, and its grain offering will be this, this, this." And it goes through a number of offerings. The burnt offering shall be this, and its grain offering shall be this. And so it shows us that they are to be offered consecutively, but during the same ceremony. Now, let's go back now to Genesis 4. Genesis 4. So I want to mention something that I thought was an interesting thought regarding the burnt offering and the grain offering, these two types, these two categories of offering. There's perhaps an interesting perspective to this in the context of Cain and Abel, and perhaps giving us a little bit of an explanation as to what was going on during the process of time when these two men came to God to give an offering, or at least came before God, you know, spiritually to give him an offering. Now Genesis 4 in verse 3 says that in the process of time, and this is an expression meaning at the end of days or counting days, so it was likely during the Feast of Weeks or at the Feast of Weeks when they came, in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Eternal. And Abel, also he brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat, in other words, the best of his animals. And the Eternal respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. And so Cain brought of the fruit of the ground. Abel brought clean animals to be offered to God, and God respected Abel. He respected his offering. He didn't respect Cain and his offering. And so the question that many ask and wonder about and speculate on is why? Why didn't God have respect for the offering that Cain brought? Well, it could be this. It could be that God saw Cain as being hypocritical. That here he is bringing an offering to God that's, you know, supposed to be showing a love for God, but he doesn't have a love for his own brother. He, in fact, was, you know, it looks like he didn't like his brother at all, according to what happened later. And so, the disdain that Cain had for Abel was probably felt for some time. It wasn't as a result of this instance of the offerings here, I don't think. I mean, you just don't go out and kill somebody because of a single event. I don't see it as being a sudden fit of rage that Cain had. And God said to Cain in Genesis 4 and verse 6, after it says that, he was angry, and or Cain was angry and his countenance had fallen, God said to him, "If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, to have you, to take control of you, but you should rule over it." So in other words, God saw that there was something going on within Cain internally, in his mind, in his heart, and he said, if you do well, you don't have to worry about it. You're going to be accepted, but if not, if you're, you know, hanging on to these thoughts, if you're entertaining them, if you're wanting to focus on them, they want to take control of you. But you need to get control of this yourself. You need to take care of it. And so Abel did not take care of it, and we know the story. It eventually got the worst of him in that Abel murdered his brother. And I think this is in part why Christ said that, you know, he said later during his ministry that if you have a conflict with your brother and you're going to bring an offering to God, to present an offering before the altar, leave the offering, go resolve the conflict with your brother, and then come back and make the offering to God. And then you will be accepted. It will be accepted. And so Jesus Christ is the God of the Old Covenant, despite what some might try to teach today. He is the God of the Old Covenant. It says he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And I think this is likely in part why he did not respect Cain in his offering. It was because Cain hated his brother. He was angry without a cause, as if there's ever a good cause. And in this way, you know, Christ related later that to hate somebody is related to murdering them. And so Cain was already killing his brother in his heart. And eventually, of course, the hatred we know led to the greater sin. So I think this is related to the grain offering that is for God on the altar and also given to Aaron and his sons, that, you know, we cannot love God and exclude having a love for our brother. We need to do both. And so let's go now back to Leviticus 2. I want to examine now some of the components of the grain offering in detail to understand how they further represent Christ and how they are related to us. Now, we had already read in the first verses here, I don't know if I read verse 3 or not, but we'll go ahead and read it again. But when we first read Leviticus 2, we saw that the offering, the grain offering, or at least this one way the grain offering was presented, was to be a fine flour with oil and frankincense. And so what that means is, I might call it a raw offering because that's an expression we would relate to, in the sense that it was not cooked into a form of bread that is, you know, that tastes good, is easy to eat. You could tear off a piece of bread and eat it, but it was just the raw ingredients here. But these ingredients could be prepared differently. Now it says, after verse 2, speaking of those first ingredients, then it says the rest of the grain offering, that is the rest that is not put on the altar, shall be Aaron and his sons. It's most holy of the offerings to the Eternal made by fire. And then it goes on to say, and if you bring as an offering a grain offering baked in the oven, it shall be unleavened cakes of fine flour mixed with oil, or unleavened wafers anointed with oil. And it's basically just two forms of bread there, cooked in a similar way. But if your offering is a grain offering baked in a pan, it shall be a fine flour, unleavened, mixed with oil. You shall break it in pieces and pour oil on it. It is a grain offering. And if your offering is a grain offering baked in a covered pan, and again, these are just different methods of cooking the food here, it shall be made of fine flour with oil, and you shall bring the grain offering that is made of these things to the Eternal, and when it is presented to the priest, he shall bring it to the altar. And then the priest shall take from the grain offering a memorial portion and burn it on the altar. It is an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to the Eternal. And what is left of the grain offering shall be Aaron's and his sons. It is most holy of the offerings to the Eternal made by fire. And then he says something to reiterate, but also says something else that's interesting. No grain offering which you bring to the Eternal shall be made with leaven, for you shall burn no leaven nor any honey in any offering to the Eternal made by fire. So in all of these offerings that we have read about so far in Leviticus 2, they all consisted of fine flour that could not contain leaven. And this is another clue to the representation of this offering representing Christ. So we're familiar with the symbolism of leaven being pride and the associated sin that comes with the pride of life, lust of the flesh. And Christ was without, obviously, Christ was without this character flaw found in the representation of leaven, and thus the offering placed on the altar could not contain any leaven. Now, there was an exception to this. There were wave loaves that were presented on the Feast of Weeks, also known as Pentecost, and this was the only offering that was not only allowed to contain leaven, in fact, it was required that these two loaves of bread contained leaven. But those loaves were not put on the altar. As it says, no leaven is to be put on the altar. Those two loaves, they were waved, and they were considered to be for holy use, but they were given to the priest. So that offering, I think, is likely what is intended when it speaks in the next verse here, verse 12. And as for the offering of the first fruits, you shall offer them to the Eternal, but they shall not be burned on the altar for a sweet aroma. And so it is that the wave loaves of Pentecost were not to be put on the altar. And many commentators, in fact, even agree that this verse is a reference to the Feast of Weeks offering. They couldn't be burned because it's something that we wouldn't want to offer sin to God, make an offering of sin symbolized by leaven to God. And I'm going to talk more about that later as we move on. But the standard grain offering could not contain leaven, and as I had stated at the beginning, it was to include salt. And that's, we find that in the next verse here in verse 13, where it says, "And every offering of your grain offering you shall season with salt. You shall not allow the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings you shall offer salt." And so as we continue to break these components down here, we find that there are interesting parallels and representations to the life of Christ. And so let's consider first the fine flour here. See, the grain, it had to be beaten, it had to be bruised, it had to be ground down in order to produce something that is described as fine flour, a consistency of flour. And fine means that the grinding would be thorough, very thorough in this process. And there's an expression in the book of Isaiah 28 and verse 28, and I'm not going to turn there, but I'm going to read it. It says that bread flour must be ground. And so it was. We see that Christ, he was beaten. He was bruised. He was ground down. He took the punishment that sinners actually deserve, even though there was no sin in him. And so we see how Christ experienced the most terrible, tragic, if you will, the beating and the ridicule that he suffered was the worst you can imagine. And even though he endured it, it doesn't mean that, you know, he was okay with it. You know, that means he didn't feel anything, that he was just stoic through the entire event. No, he was deeply moved by this event, or these events. He was moved, in fact, by the betrayal of Judas Iscariot. We see how his sweat appeared to be like great drops of blood while he was praying to the Father and asking the Father if there was any other way to do this. Can we please do that? Nonetheless, he said, "Not my will, but yours be done." And we see that even when he was hanging on the stake, the life literally draining out of him, that he had compassion on those people who were sobbing and grieving at the sight of his own suffering. None of us, I don't think, fully understand the measure of Christ's sufferings, being rejected, being misunderstood, being bruised and beaten, and having bits of flesh torn off of his body as he was whipped. When it was time then for his crucifixion to come, you know, we see that he was already ground down. He had like little to no energy left, and he was so weak that the scriptures relate that he couldn't even carry his own stake to the site of the crucifixion. And so there was another man that carried it for him. And perhaps some people see it as, well, that was an act of kindness by this other man. But I look at it as this was out of necessity. He literally could not do this. So Christ went through all of this, and he was ready to be put on the altar as an offering to God. But the torment wasn't over after he arrived at the place of the skull, Golgotha there. We then see that 9-inch nails were hammered through his wrists. They were hammered through his ankles. And the pole was raised up. And as he hung on the stake there, he would try to catch his breath and pulling himself up so that he could breathe and letting himself down. And then his lungs being crushed and up so he could breathe and letting himself down. And it's torturous to think of such a thing happening, but that is how it played out. And so he hung there on that stake, slowly suffocating, while he was also bleeding to death. This had to be done, though. This is the way God wanted it to be done in order for us to realize the kind of commitment that he has for us, that he had even from the beginning, when the earth was first made. It had to be done in order for us to have the opportunity that you and I have to give an offering to God and to have an opportunity for salvation. And for this reason, we see that Christ is called the light and the life of men. And he's also called the bread of life. Now, bread is said to be the stay or the staff of life. And that is not an exact biblical term, but it is an appropriate description that comes from some verses in the Bible. And Christ referred to himself even as the true manna from heaven, bread from heaven, the bread of life. And he is the reason, the very reason why many people will be chosen to receive eternal life. Let's go to 1 Peter and chapter 4. A portion of the grain or the bread of the offering was burned in the fire, the brazen altar there. It was symbolized being presented before very God. And the symbolism of the fire is that of trials. Now Christ, he experienced the most severe trials imaginable. And the symbolism of trials found in fire can be found in several places of the Bible when we examine it. And I don't have them all written down here, but I do have one that I would like to read. In 1 Peter 4, in verse 12, it says, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you, but rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings in this way by the fiery trials, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. If you're reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the spirit of glory and of God rests upon you." And so the trials that Christ endured are similar to the ones that you and I may have or will face. Now, they're not going to be exactly the same, I don't think, but perhaps in certain ways they might. I mean, some of the apostles experienced trials that were nearly exact to the ones that Christ experienced, and all of ours might be slightly different, and the circumstances might be different because we're all different. We all have different needs. We have different refinements of our character that God needs to see happen in us. And though some circumstances that we face may be the same or similar, I think all of us are going to experience or have experienced some of these trials by fire, fiery trials, as Peter put it. If you go back to 1 Samuel 16, I want to talk a little bit now about the second ingredient, the ingredient of oil. This was to be offered along with the grain offering, and whether it was fine flour that was cooked beforehand or not. And oil can be used and is used in the scriptures in several ways. It can be used to anoint someone who is ill. It was used to ordain certain individuals to a position of authority, whether a king or the priest. And so oil, we're very familiar with the concept of oil representing God's Holy Spirit. Aaron was anointed with oil as high priest, and this was to be God's spirit being put in him if it was not beforehand. Saul was anointed, and this king was given a measure of understanding according to God's spirit, even though King Saul did not use the spirit of God wisely. He denied it seems often. We see that King David, that he was anointed with oil. And this again portrayed God giving David his spirit. And this is shown in 1 Samuel 16 in verse 13. One more page. Where it says, Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed David in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Eternal came upon David from that day forward. And so we see that King David continued to have God's Holy Spirit from that time forward. And it led him in many ways. He was not always led by God's Spirit. We see that David was not a perfect man, but he did come mature as he grew in God's grace. That is God's influence on his heart, and that was reflected in his life much of the time. Now, in the same context here, I'm not going to turn there. I have it in my notes. I'd just like you to listen to Isaiah 61 in verses 1 and 2, where it says that the Spirit of the Eternal God is upon me, because the Eternal has appointed me to preach good tidings to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Eternal and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn. And so we see that this is prophetic. It's speaking of Christ, but it applied to Isaiah the prophet as well, to a degree, who was also given God's Spirit. And it starts by seeing the Spirit of the Eternal, or the Spirit of the Lord, is upon me. And so God's Spirit was given to these individuals, an anointing, if you will, of God's Spirit for a purpose and for a cause. Now Christ, he had the Spirit of God from birth. It also says that he had the Spirit without measure. It was seen, actually literally seen, coming upon him. It appeared to be like a dove that descended upon him when he was baptized by John in the Jordan. And Christ already had the Spirit, but I think this was for other people's sake, so that they could say, this is God's anointed. Literally, this is the Messiah, and we have seen a miracle. It happened right before our eyes. Now that Spirit, it came from the Father, and it gave Christ the fortitude necessary to continue, even when Christ was beaten and when he was ground down. He had the power, he had the mental strength to say, I'm going to continue. I am going to keep going. And this is because the Spirit of God was in him and it was with him, just as the oil was in and with the grain offering, an inseparable part of the offering. And so something that we can take away from this is that when you and I feel like times are getting really hard, this is too difficult for us to bear, and I've said that at times, that I don't know if I can take much more of this, I don't know if I can take it any longer, but when we find that it gets to that point, maybe we should consider asking God for more of his Spirit. Give me the mental strength. Give me the power to continue. And because God can, and he will encourage us in this way, if we are working toward it, you know, if we're not actively and willfully sinning, that he will work with us. He'll give us more of his Spirit. As it says, you know, when a son asks his father for a fish, is he going to give him a scorpion? No, he's going to give him something that's good for him, that's beneficial for them. Another example is found in the book of Zechariah, and I'm not going to turn there, but you can write it down if you want. Zechariah 4 and verse 6. The prophet Zechariah had a vision of the two witnesses, and they appeared in his vision as two olive trees that were burning with oil. The prophet was told this in chapter 4 and verse 6. He said, not by might nor by power, but by my Spirit, says the Eternal of Hosts. In other words, what he was saying is that champions of faith, champions that will be found in the two witnesses and others that have passed and others perhaps that are present, they will accomplish great things by having a desire to obey God, but their efforts alone will not provide the strength, it will not provide the power needed to overcome the most difficult of trials. You see, it is by the Spirit of God that we can prevail and come through successful in these situations. And if you think about a few more examples of this, that was the case when Christ was taken to the wilderness or led to the wilderness for 40 days. He fasted and then he faced the devil. And he won the battle of the ages. And the scriptures even say that it was the Spirit of God that led him to that fiery trial. That this is something that he needed to do, to face the devil, to confront him in this way, and to be tempted. Another scripture, Acts 10, verse 38, says that God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and with power. And Jesus went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. And so that is how God was with Christ, and it is also how God is with us. It is through his Spirit. And like the grain offering, therefore, it had a measure of oil. You and I must have a measure of God's Spirit. And we can have it if we follow the moral code of behavior, just as the offering was to be presented to God in a particular manner. It had to be exactly this way. And there were several different ways, but it had to be one of those ways. The people couldn't make up their own way how they were going to give the offering to God. The grain offering had to be done in this manner. Just like we can't make up our own moral laws. We don't actually have the capacity to do so. We're always going to mess it up. So God did it for us. He gave us the moral laws by which all of mankind should live by. Because he knows this is going to work. This will work for you. Let's go to 1 Peter 2. Another ingredient found in the grain offering was to be the, along with the flour, along with the oil, was frankincense. Now, frankincense comes from a variety of trees that are found in the genus Boswellia. And I don't have any pictures. I didn't have the time to look up some pictures of these trees, but it comes from the sap from this type of tree, the sap is usually obtained by making a small incision in the trunk of the tree, and at the end of the growing season, the sap will run out of the tree, much like getting, you know, maple syrup from the trees. So the sap will run out, and it hardens to form a resin. Now, the resin of this sap can be burned as incense. Now, today, some people actually mix, you know, they'll grind up some of the frankincense and they'll mix it with some oils to make a variety of essential oil compounds. Some people actually claim it has like magical properties, which of course we don't believe in, but it does have properties that are very beneficial. It can be, as we see in the grain offering, it can be used sparingly in food, and it was to be combined with the oil and the flour. Now, there was one study I read about this. I found this kind of interesting, so I'm going to read a little bit of this study of frankincense, where it says the effect of frankincense is remarkable, increasing the number of dendritic segments in branching in the neuron cells of the hippocampus, causing more synaptic connections in that area, and therefore improvement of learning and memory. According to the Essential Oils Desk reference, studies have shown that a compound of frankincense resin protects the nervous system, and that many of the biochemicals in essential oils, particularly sesquiterpenes, I don't know how to pronounce that, can increase blood oxygen levels in the brain. It may therefore alleviate anxiety that results from inflammation, pathogens, and other factors. In addition, they continue to say its anti-inflammatory effects may improve the body's response to other antimicrobial treatments, such that support a healthy immune response, and help to quell symptoms of pain and fatigue, among other issues. And there is one type of frankincense they mentioned called Frerinia frankincense, has been shown in studies to reduce arthritis symptoms, which are common in people with Lyme disease. In a review published in 2013 in the Journal of Traditional Complementary Medicine, describes the antimicrobial and other effects of the compounds found in frankincense. Now, what I've also read when I looked at this for a little, I don't know, I spent maybe a half an hour looking at this subject, is that not all forms of frankincense are food grade. And the reason I mention it is because I don't want somebody to hear this and say, "Ah, I'm going to start eating frankincense now." It should be used sparingly, from what I understand, and I would say not without consulting a healthcare professional for perhaps some advice, because there are some people that may have adverse reactions to consuming frankincense. But clearly, the form that Israel was told to use for the grain offering was a food-grade form of frankincense, and some of this was to be put on the altar, and the rest was given to the priests for personal use. And I think the inclusion of frankincense in the offering gave it an added pleasant aroma when it was burned. This would add, of course, to the sweet, the pleasant-smelling aroma in the offering. In fact, the full fragrance of frankincense is not brought out unless it's burned in the fire. And of course, again, we see this symbolism of being a reflection of Christ, because the trials that he experienced, the fiery trials that he experienced, gave rise to the sweetness of his nature. It became evident to God the Father and to all of us. Now notice some of the sweetness here. In 1 Peter 2, Peter was there. He saw everything that Christ had done. And he said, that's more one. Okay, 1 Peter 2. In verse 21, "For to this reason you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps." And he gave a few examples here of Christ, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. So Christ offered his entire life in service to God, and he did it on our behalf. It was for God, but also for us. And so this was pleasing to the Father, a sweet aroma in his nostrils. And of course, we're reminded then of the sentiment when Christ was baptized, when a voice was heard coming from the heavens that said, "Behold, my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." And God was well pleased with him from an early age, as he also grew in grace and knowledge, as it says in Luke chapters 1 and 2. And 1 Corinthians 4, now let's go over to 1 Corinthians 4. The offering that each of us give to God, it should be of similar quality to the offering that Christ gave to God. And that was what the Apostle Peter said. And so what we offer to God is always to be related to these basic components. Because if you think about it, when you break the grain offering down, it had several basic components. A lot could be said about them. A lot, and we're only covering in part this evening some of that, but they're fairly basic. So in like manner, the offering that we give to God is directly related to some basic components, keeping the commandments. Now, a lot can be said about the commandments. I mean, the Ten Commandments are like an umbrella, and there are many other laws and principles that fall under the Ten Commandments, but it is something that you and I are required to do. It's a reasonable service. And so the Apostle Paul wrote this in 1 Corinthians 4, In verse 9, he said, "For I think that God has displayed us, the apostles last, as men condemned for death, for we have been made a spectacle to the world, both to angels and to men. We are fools for Christ's sake," that is, and people consider them to be fools for Christ's sake, "but you are wise in Christ. We are weak, but you are strong. You are distinguished, but we are dishonored." And these are kind of being, you know, he's using some sarcasm here. People are dishonoring them, but they were not dishonorable. "To the present hour, we both hunger and thirst, and we are poorly clothed and beaten and homeless, and we labor, working with our own hands. Being reviled, we bless. Being persecuted, we endure." Sounds a lot like what Christ did, right? "Being defamed, we entreat. We have been made as filth of the world, the offscouring of all things until now. I do not write these things to shame you, but as my beloved children, I warn you." He was warning them. Christ experienced those things. The apostles experienced those things. And it's likely that some of us are going to experience such trials. And so we're warned that these trials may come, that they are challenges. There will be confrontations that some will face. But don't be discouraged. Do not be afraid of them. We can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. And that is what Paul said. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Through God's Spirit that strengthens me, I can endure these things. God will see us through, as the hymn we sing occasionally at services, hymn 61, I believe. And so let's go to Leviticus 2 again, all the way back to Leviticus 2. The fourth ingredient of the grain offering was salt. And this is said in Leviticus 2. In verse 13 it says, "And every offering of your grain offering you shall season with salt. You shall not allow the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings you shall offer salt." Now salt, we are well aware, is used as a, for one, as a flavor enhancer, but we also are probably aware that it's used as a preservative. And therefore, salt pictures something. It pictures something that will last because its properties protect against corruption. Now, it's interesting that the verse that we had just read, God calls this component the salt of the covenant. And so what this means is a covenant of perpetuity, something that is going to last. And so we can compare the covenant God made with the priests. And you don't have to turn there, but Numbers 18 and verse 19, where it speaks of the heave offerings and the holy things which the children of Israel offer to the Eternal, God said, "I have given to you and your sons and daughters with you as an ordinance forever. It is a covenant of salt forever before the Eternal with you and your descendants with you." And so this was something that God said, this is going to last. It's going to continue to be with you and your descendants after you as priests unto God. And so we see that even when Christ returns and the millennial temple is built, that the sons of Zadok will be priests in the temple. And they will receive these things. The Levites will receive these things, these offerings. They will be able to use them. And just to point out, the sons of Zadok are actually descendants of Aaron. So this can also be compared, this covenant of salt, it can be compared to the covenant that God made with David. And he had promised that David would always have a descendant overseeing the people of Israel, and he called it in 2 Chronicles 13:5, and I'm not sure if God called it this or the person who wrote 2 Chronicles was inspired to call it a covenant of salt. Let's go over to Deuteronomy 29. So what I am getting at here is that God has made a covenant with many people. It's an enduring covenant, and it is a covenant of salt in this way. It is going to last. It will lead to something that will ultimately last forever. And so this is a contract that you and I have with God that requires us to what? Keep the commandments. That is the covenant that we have made with him. We have promised to keep the commandments. And so this covenant has endured the ages, and it is offered to those people who are called unto liberty, not an opportunity of the flesh, but to be liberated from the life that we now live by keeping God's commandments. Now notice what it says in Deuteronomy 29. Deuteronomy 29, verse 14, when he made this covenant with the people of Israel, and it's talking about keeping his laws, it says, I make this covenant and this oath. Did I tell you the verse, verse 14? Okay. I make this covenant and this oath, not with you alone, but with him who stands here with us today before the eternal our God. So it's talking about the mixed multitude. You didn't have to be a literal descendant of Jacob in order to enter into this covenant of God, but you had to commit to keeping his commandments. So he makes it with those who stand here with us today before the eternal our God. And then notice this. It says, as well as with him or her, I might add, who is not here with us today. And so my point is, all of us have been able to enter into this type of a covenant. It is a new covenant, also called by some the New Testament, but it requires still the same principles of keeping the commandments. We have to be committed to this, to keep the commandments. And if we don't, the contract's broken. But don't say that God broke it. If we don't keep his commandments, if we choose not to follow God and to keep his moral laws, we are the ones breaking the covenant, not him. And so we're bound to it, though. We're bound to keep the commandments. And the point is, I think this is directly related to the covenant of salt. Matthew 5. For this reason, Christ said this in Matthew 5. He referred to Christians, people of God, as being salt. In Matthew 5 and verse 13, he said, you are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Well, this is, you know, the covenant that you and I make with God. It's a commitment to live by his laws. It means that we are going to be pure, you know, that we will live purely, and that it doesn't mean we're going to be without flaw, that we can never make a mistake. We try not to, but if we do, we can repent and we can be restored in that relationship. And so, as salt did not allow things to become corrupt, to be preserved, we do not allow ourselves to become corrupted by the ways of this world. And this is something that you and I have to commit to doing if we hope to be preserved. That is, if we hope to have eternal life. And so Christ asks the question, you know, what if the salt loses its flavor? You know, what happens if we allow ourselves to become corrupted and we lose the flavor? If we choose to participate in sin instead, is the flavor still good? If we deny God, if we don't keep his commandments, no, it's not. You're breaking the covenant. It's good for nothing, it says. It's just throw it out. And so we have to be committed to this. We have to be committed to being pure. And this is how we retain the flavor that we get from God through his Spirit. And it's the flavor that God intends for the salt of the earth, the people of God, to have. Mark chapter 9. Mark Christ had said that his yoke is easy and that his burden is light. And that was said in Matthew chapter 11. But, you know, he was speaking relatively, comparatively, if you will. You know, it's not difficult to keep the commandments, really. It's easy to make an offering to God. Tithing is not difficult. Keeping the Sabbath holy is simple, you know. But the challenge in keeping the obeying the moral laws of God consistently and constantly is with the trials that we face, the situations that we face that push us to think, well, you know, if I just bent a little bit, it would be easier to get through this situation. If I just lied a little, you know, a little lie would put me in the clear, and I wouldn't have to suffer. But that's where the challenge comes in, right? That's where the trial comes in. So fiery trials portray those things that are difficult to endure. They can be difficult to endure, but of course, this is a part of the seasoning process. It's part of the process found in building of our character to become more and more like Him. In Mark 9, verse 49, it says, "For everyone will be seasoned with fire, and every sacrifice will be seasoned with salt." Why do you think he used this reference here, if he was not pointing back to the offerings? Salt is good, but if the salt loses its flavor, how will you season it? "Well, have salt, therefore, in yourselves, and have peace with one another." And so here we go, relating the two aspects of the offering, the love for God and the love for others. You know, how do we have peace with one another? It's not by bending our morals, you know, lowering our standards. That doesn't make for peace. Oh, they might feel at peace, but we certainly don't feel at peace with that. No, it's through the foundation of the law, always keeping the commandments, no matter what, because the foundation of God's commandments are love. And even if people don't like what we might do at times because we have standards that we will not bend on, eventually they'll see it. And I face those situations. We probably have all faced those situations at times where we said, you know, I just can't do that. I can't go along with that. And maybe that ruffled some feathers at first. But then later we see that those people had a greater respect for you, or they understood. And I've even seen it happen within minutes that the person will turn around and go, you know, that's the right thing to do, Terry. And they didn't actually say that to me, but I could tell that they understood that that's the right thing to do. And so that is what the grain offering is about. If we lose this foundation that is a love for God, if we lose the foundation of having a love for others, then we lose the flavor of the salt. We break the covenant, and it's not good for anything anymore. And of course, I think the way that we can tell that if perhaps we might be losing our flavor is this. Are we obeying God? Are we doing what God requires? Are we keeping the commandments? And again, there's so much to be said about the commandments, because the 10 are related to other moral laws that fall underneath the umbrella. Let's go back to Leviticus 2. Leviticus 2. We're getting close to the end here. There's something else that I want to mention briefly in the grain offering, and that's the different ways that the grain could be offered. Now, God allowed and He even commanded that different forms of the offering were to be given at different times. There was the raw form, as I had mentioned, which consists of fine flour, oil, frankincense, and salt. It wasn't to be cooked into the form of bread, but it was still to be offered. There are other forms that were described that we read through, such as the unleavened cakes, and it had the same components, the fine flour and the oil. There were unleavened wafers that it says were anointed with oil. There were grain offerings that were baked in a pan, again, still fine flour, and they were not to be leavened, no leaven. And also grain that was baked in a covered pan, and it's just a different way of cooking the mixture. Still, again, fine flour and oil. And these methods were allowed for various reasons, but they were treated the same when they were offered, that there was a portion, a memorial portion, that was taken out and put on the altar, and then there was the rest of it was to be given to the priests. Now, what I find very interesting is a description of two grain offerings that are both called first fruit offerings. And these were prepared differently, different than the others that I just mentioned. Now, understanding that grain offerings were given all throughout the year, there were two grain offerings that had to be made at specific times of the year. And now these offerings were extra special offerings, and they had to be prepared in a particular manner. So the inclusion of these two first fruit offerings is why I believe God said this in Leviticus 2 and verse 12, where he said, "As for the offering of the first fruits, you shall offer them to the Eternal, but they shall not be burned, no memorial portion taken out of them. They shall not be burned and on the altar for a sweet aroma." And then it says, you know, every offering should be seasoned with salt. Don't allow the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt. And then it talks about another offering, also called a first fruit offering. It says, "If you offer a grain offering of your first fruits to the Eternal, you shall offer for the grain offering of your first fruits green heads of grain roasted on the fire, grain beaten from full heads. And you shall put oil on it and lay frankincense on it. It is a grain offering. And then the priest shall burn the memorial portion, part of its beaten grain and part of its oil, with all the frankincense, as an offering made by fire to the Eternal." Let's go to Leviticus 23. And so the one offering that we had read about in verse 12 of chapter 2, I think refers to the wave loaves. And these are loaves, they were called first fruits to the Eternal. And they are considered to be a new grain offering, according to Leviticus 23. And they were presented before God, that is, lifted and waved before him on the holy day of the Feast of Weeks, also known as Pentecost. And so let's read about that for just a moment. In Leviticus 23 and verse 15, "You shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. Count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath, and then you shall offer a new grain offering to the Eternal. You shall bring from your dwellings 2 loaves of 2/10 of an ephah, and they shall be of fine flour. They shall be baked with leaven. They are the first fruits to the Eternal." So again, it's this description of the grain offering here. And then it goes on to say that you shall offer with the bread 7 lambs of the first year without blemish, 1 young bull, 2 rams, and they shall be a burnt offering to the Eternal with their grain offering and their drink offerings, an offering made by fire for a sweet aroma to the Eternal. And then it goes on to say, "You shall sacrifice 1 kid of the goats as a sin offering and 2 male lambs of the first year as a sacrifice of a peace offering. And the priest shall wave them," speaking of these 2 loaves, "the priest shall wave them with the bread of the first fruits as a wave offering before the Eternal. With the 2 lambs, they shall be holy to the Eternal for the priest." And so it is that we have this grain offering here that was required to contain leaven. They were not placed on the altar, though. There was no memorial portion taken out of it. not a sweet aroma as they burned, but they represented, therefore, the people of the first resurrection. And you and I are well very familiar with this. We've heard about it for, I don't know, the last 8 years. We've been talking about it in the sermons. We even put it in a few booklets, the meaning of Pentecost and how it's related to the wave loaves. But because the loaves were not put on the altar as a sweet aroma, I don't want people to think, well, this does not mean that the offerings you and I might make, you know, the people of God might make to God, are not pleasing to him, that he doesn't find anything pleasurable in it. You know, we're all flawed in various ways, but we can and do things that God approves of, that he enjoys to see us keeping his commandments, because he knows that produces happiness, it produces joy, it produces a future. It gives way to a future and a relationship that you and I can have with him, and that is pleasing in the eyes of God. But the wave loaves could not contain leaven, because it's a rule that no component of pride or sin should be presented before God as an offering. You know, we present our lives in obedience, in purity as an offering to God, not a life of sin. We're not going to go sin and say, here, God, here's my sin, take that as an offering. No. And so it is that this grain offering was not burned, and it's very different than the offerings in that it contained leaven. Now, the wave sheaf offering that was given 50 days prior to the Feast of Weeks, this was an offering also considered a grain offering, and so it could not include leaven. Now notice what is said about this sheaf in Leviticus 23 and verse 10, where it says, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. You shall wave the sheaf before the Eternal to be accepted on your behalf. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. And you shall offer on that day when you wave the sheaf a male lamb of the first year without blemish as a burnt offering to the Eternal. And its grain offering shall be 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, an offering made by fire to the Eternal for a sweet aroma. And its drink offering shall be of wine 1/4 of a hin." And so the wave sheaf, again, we are well aware that the wave sheaf represented Jesus Christ. And therefore, it's my belief that the second mention of the first fruit grain offering in Leviticus chapter 2, if you want to go back there, Leviticus 2, the second mention of a grain offering that is considered to be a first fruit offering is speaking of the wave sheaf. Now look at it again in the last few verses here. Verse 14, it says, "If you offer a grain offering of your first fruits to the Eternal, you shall offer for the grain offering of your first fruits green heads of grain roasted on the fire." Grain beaten from full heads. Well, when would the grain be green? It would be at the time of the wave sheaf, the beginning of the year, when the grain would still be green. And so, and practically speaking, there would be a need to dry it in the fire so that you could beat it to get the grain out of it. "And you shall put oil on it and lay frankincense on it. It's a grain offering. And the priest shall burn the memorial portion of it, of its beaten grain and part of its oil with all the frankincense as an offering made by fire to the Eternal." So we see that this particular offering, it doesn't say that it had to consist of fine flour. This one in particular, it doesn't say, you know, it needed to be ground. It was dried by fire. The heads were beaten to remove the grain, and it still included the oil. It still included the frankincense here, and a memorial portion of it was put on the altar. And so I think this is likely talking about the wave sheaf that was given before the first fruit offering of the wave loaves. Now, when I was pondering this, I saw an interesting translation of a few of these verses found in the CEV translation, which is known as the Contemporary English Version. Frankly, I would not recommend using that translation primarily because I think they do take some liberties. But something that they had said in this regard is kind of interesting. When they translated Leviticus 23:10, they say, "After you enter the land I am giving you, the first bundle of wheat must be given to me. Bring it to the priest." And when it comes to Leviticus 2 and verse 14 and 16, they translate it as, "Freshly cut grain, either roasted or coarsely ground, must be used when you offer the first part of your grain harvest. You must mix in some olive oil and put some incense on top, because this is a grain sacrifice. And a priest will sprinkle all the incense and some of the grain and oil on the altar and send them up in smoke to show that the whole offering belongs to me." So again, I think that's a fairly liberal translation, but perhaps it might help us to put this in context of what it is probably referring to, and it does give us some food for thought. Seeing my last page of notes, 12. I'll see page 12 here. I think I could probably summarize it on my own, but it would have been nice to have it. It might be in there in the storage room. But in any case, we see that there is so much that actually can be said about the grain offering and all that it included, and whether it be the components or how it was treated or the symbolism that's involved in all of this. And so with that in mind, I just want to remind us that the symbolism is, of course, primarily relating to Christ, but it also directly relates to each one of us, and that Christ had a love for God first and foremost, as it being the first and great commandment. But there is also this love for our fellow man that must be involved as well. And in every case, the grain offering, we see it wasn't entirely burned. So there was a portion that was put on the altar, showing us that there is an offering that we give to God. And there was a portion that was given to the priests, meaning that this offering that we give to God is also for the sake of other individuals. And the example in this, of course, Christ is the bread of life. He presented himself as an offering to God. And this offering was not just for God's benefit. It was for our benefit as well. So in like manner, when we go about doing what we might call our business, let's let it be God's business, because even though we might not directly be doing work for the church or, you know, publishing literature or giving sermons, everything that we do in obedience to God is for his sake, and it's also for the sake of others. And think about this, that if we happen to be one of those few that are chosen, that it's all going to be for other people, that our entire service from that point forward is in service to God, but for the sake of other individuals. And so for this reason, this is a covenant of salt that you and I have with him. It's something that will eventually last forever. And so everything we do in life, therefore, should be directly connected to this work of obedience to God, of keeping the commandments. Everything that we do should be within the framework of God's moral law. And in this way, therefore, our entire life is an offering to God, whether it's put on the altar or not. It's all to serve God. And in return, we will be given a portion, an even larger portion, of life back to us. You know, what is your life but a vapor? It's just a small amount of time. What is that compared to eternity. And so let's be reminded of this in the grain offering, that we are to be like Christ, and that you and I are to be about our Father's business. So that ends the Bible study this evening. Wow, I went, almost an hour and a half. All right, well, I'm going to go ahead and sign off on the conference call and also shut down the live video streams, and we will dial into the other conferencing number to see if anybody has any questions or comments. Any of you that might have attended with us online, if you are interested in participating in the discussion after the Bible studies or after Sabbath services, please contact us and you can get some more information on how to do that. All right. God be with you, everyone.